Well, hi, welcome everybody. I hope you're all doing great. I really appreciate the responses to the questions and the feedback that you've sent in about our first seminar. I wanted to reserve, as I mentioned just briefly, the beginning of last seminar, a discussion time at the beginning to see what kind of questions and thoughts you have. If you'll manage the background noise, remember that any movement in the background, even you walking across the room if you have a headset, it's picking up the sound. So if you would mute until you're ready to comment or ask a question. A couple of things I wanted to respond to and initiate a discussion and then see what else you have and check in with each of you. This is a composite of three or four really, really excellent questions. What can we do when someone persists in their default patterns? Well, this is exactly why we get paid big money in coaching, because this is the challenge. Because as we discussed, 90 to 95% of the operating of someone's operating system is unconscious. So there can be biases, beliefs, all the underlying algorithms that determine behavior, feeling, a number of things are there. So that's important to really understand as we're doing our work in coaching and to listen for. Here is a short list of some of the anatomical realities in your brain. Facts, beliefs, identity, patterns such as attachment, emotional, behavioral, because anything we repeat enough, it'll hardwire. Now, change can occur, but it will be basically internal, not from facts or information or data, not from offering something that's a better suggestion or a better answer, but beginning with where the client is. Often, though, it's an external catalyst or situation, but then we still have to begin with where the client is. Some of you have done this before. On a clean sheet of paper, so you'll have room to write other stuff if anything else grabs you, draw a circle, just one big circle in the middle of that page. Inside that circle, draw a stick figure. Now, that stick figure is your client. For that client to really listen to you, for you to develop an alliance and collaborate with that client, your challenge is to get inside the circle. Outside the circle, client's not going to listen to you. You can give all kind of information. You can have the most current and relevant, compelling research. You're not going to get to that client until you get in the circle. How do you do that? Begin with where the client is. Often that's a state of mind. You resonate with the client's experience. Then you can go someplace new together. Then you can create a foundation, a bedrock of communication to go forward. Now, I know a couple of you have heard this story. This was my best supervision about this process. It occurred many, many years ago when I was still practicing psychoanalysis. I offered what I thought was a really savvy interpretation to a woman executive who was on the couch in analysis, and I offered it to her because I thought it would really be helpful. And there was a pause, and the pause got longer. And finally, she got up on one elbow, looked back at me in my analytic chair, and said, "No, Kruger, first you've got to be with me before I can go someplace new with you." The best, most brilliant, most succinct supervision I've ever had about this process of collaboration. That's getting in the circle with the stick figure. We have to be with our clients before they will begin to think about going someplace new with us. So how do you illuminate biases, beliefs, or assumptions? Well, one way is simply to ask for a belief. Well, how do you know that? Or how would you know if it's not working? Or what might it be costing you to think like that? So we're going to return to this and look at developing this, and especially in light of the roadmap system. And we're going to begin that this time. And as we began talking last time a bit, and in response initially, this application of algorithms, which is simply a finite series of steps to solve a problem, addresses how to understand and change your story or create a new one. We're going to focus on money story, but it'll work for any story, your wellness story, your life story, your relationship story. So the roadmap system is simply a systematic way of looking at the steps to understand the components of the story in order to know what to change and then how to change it. We'll be looking at that specifically over the next this and the next two seminars. What I want to do, I have so many excellent questions I'd like to elaborate, but I want to preserve the time for the seminar and incorporate some of them there, but still, there's going to be some left over. I want to offer a discussion time at the end of our final seminar, week four, for us to hang out and just have a discussion, if you'd like, after the top of the hour for 10, 15, 20 minutes, if you're interested in doing that. So at this point, anything right now you'd like to add or ask in terms of last time that we talked about to clarify or add or anything just to discuss briefly before we begin with the material? And thank you for managing the background noise, by the way, and for sending some excellent questions. I'm promising to work in responses to those in a meaningful way in a context, I hope, that will give it even more meaning than just responding to the question. Anybody want to check in or add or ask anything or what you got? Anyone?
David, this is Wayne again.
Thank you. I was getting long. Go ahead there.
You just said my challenge is to get inside of the circle. I've got the circle with the screw man there standing up and down. And your first step was resonate with the client's experience.
Yes.
And the second, the best I could capture it, was like go somewhere together. And
yes.
And that's not your words, but
yeah.
But I can't remember what the third one was.
Well, you need to develop a collaborative alliance. Let me say it a different way. State is always more important than strategy and story. Whenever a client presents, their state of mind is the first thing to resonate with, especially, for example, if someone has an emotional experience, is upset, or has difficulty regulating a state of mind. You want to resonate with that client's experience, such as something simple, like, well, you know, I hear how confusing it is. Let's look at a specific way to address that. So state always comes before strategy and story, because we're inclined as coaches to move immediately into a strategy of something to do to fix it. That brings closure to the dissonance of not knowing and puts us in the position of foreclosing the experience of the client before they are really resonant with their own experience, because the most important thing I believe that we can offer clients is to help them regulate their state of mind so that they can self-reflect and do this on their own. So this is something we want to offer the client, because we're offering, can I get a management of the background noise again? If you would mute, if there's anything happening, even if you're breathing, go ahead and mute, because anything in the background, so that you can in some way reflect on the client's experience to let them know that you understand that, and that can begin self-regulation. We have an empathic understanding with a client that we communicate because this helps them to develop self-empathy. Simply saying something like, you know, that had to be very upsetting, or anything that just reflects accurately the sense of that, will help the client develop self-empathy, but immediately it will help someone get grounded and centered so that they can engage with you. Let me give you a really simple example. There have been a couple of instances where someone, a client, just had a really upsetting experience and called to say, explain just in a few seconds what had happened, and I think I need to, you know, to reschedule, to really make use of that. And I said, I understand, and I get how upsetting it was. Can we spend just a minute to do, in one case it was a mindfulness meditation, in another it was a progressive relaxation, just for a minute to help the client get really grounded and centered. In both instances, the client immediately, after doing that for just a minute, moved into the session and had a very meaningful session. My contention is that the most important thing in that entire session happened in the first minute, because that client developed a model of self-regulation and now has a way of doing that whenever I'm nowhere on the horizon. And that was later incorporated into the awareness and self-reflection that we talked about. So that's what I mean about state comes before strategy and story. In the same way, what we do is foreclose any discomfort or uncertainty that we have and the client has when we try to fix something. When we give an answer or a solution or a suggestion, it forecloses exploration, and both the client and the coach are relieved because you don't have to keep things open-ended and uncomfortable. Never mind that it's not going to work, and never mind that, oh, yeah, I moved the point of reference from developing the client story to my own because I gave an answer that was actually my answer, not the client's. But that's another illustration of a parallel process. Does that make sense, Wayne? The unmuted Wayne, does that make sense?
Unmute, and it not only makes sense, Lori Cameron, by the way, I graduated from her class last July.
Congratulations. Few people get out of there alive. No, she is great. Yeah.
Oh, she's incredible.
Oh, she is.
And I hear her saying, as you talk, don't fix it.
Yeah.
Oops, start over. Oops.
Oh, yeah. That's great.
Neutral.
It would take way longer to get that across than that. She's clear, brief, and succinct, so you're a lucky devil there. Thanks very much. Other thoughts or questions just briefly before we move into our topic today? Okay, jot down anything, and anything that you think of in between times, jot it down, and we'll either address it at the beginning or the end, or in the discussion period at the end of our last seminar. Okay, we're in conference mode now, so you don't have to worry about the background noise. So we've discussed money story and the concept of writing a new money story. Now we're going to look more closely at how to do that, at the principles and practice of understanding and change step by step, and look at the essential steps of change to create a successful new money story. So the roadmap, as I mentioned, is a macro system to deconstruct and understand a money story and systematically write new code for mind, brain, and behavior. And the roadmap, as you've probably already seen, is the acronym for the 7 steps of a systematic way to understand a story. Now, remember that, as I've mentioned before, and I will reiterate again, the idea that we're talking about, the metaphor of story, is it's our metaphor as coaches. For the client, they're not writing a story. They're not in a story. This is just the way things are. So this is our metaphor to really understand things in a more comprehensive way. And this system will help you in some way, I think, look at what to focus on, what it means, and what we can do about it. So the premise here is that whatever we think, feel, and experience, we create each moment. And in doing so, we construct our own story. So as you see in the outline, this is the roadmap to recognize authorship. You're writing your money story from assumptions to every choice about earning, spending, saving. Own your story. Accountability is a prerequisite to change. Assess the plot and the storylines. Recognize the behaviors, the messages, the language of mind and emotion. Decide what to change. Make informed choices about what story components you're going to keep, what you're going to let go, what you're going to change, what you're going to enhance. Now, as a footnote here, you'll see in the workbook that's accompanying that you probably also hopefully downloaded and printed, there are exercises that may illuminate aspects of your money story or ways to look at and understand that. So that's why I'm suggesting do the workbook along with these discussions so that you can really see and apply to put it, as we touched on briefly, to put it in an output channel for you to really engage it and look at it in different ways. To then map changes, to author new experience, to actually bring it about, and then finally, the final step, to program new identity. The most powerful force of the human psyche is our identity, and that's what we're working with in our work with a client to help them understand and incorporate a new way of seeing things, a way of transforming their operating model of how and who they are in order to make that change permanent. When change occurs that's permanent, it's because it has impacted our identity, our sense of who and what we are. If it doesn't transform identity, we'll revert back to the old way of doing things. So let's look at this more specifically now. First step, recognize authorship of your money story. So, again, this is the premise. Every moment, we actively construct what we think, feel, and experience. Each is a choice. Insight, understanding, even coming to the end of the past or the end of an old story are important, but they're not enough. You have to create a new or at least revised story. So how do you tell your money story to yourself to know what to keep and what to change? There are four principles in recognizing authorship. Principle one, our experiences are always consistent with our assumptions, which is to say that in a different way, our beliefs write the software of our behavior. And we see what we believe, and we're always right because we write the story. Here's an illustration. This is out of Oxford a number of years ago. Two anthropologists were chosen to enter separate, essentially identical ape colonies to live and observe for a year. They each had remarkable similarities of personality, philosophy, training, education. The two anthropologists were in their respective ape colonies for a year, didn't communicate with each other or anyone, and then emerged at a year to compare notes. And they expected remarkable similarities, but instead they found essential discrepancies. One anthropologist, after an initial period of transition, was accepted by the apes, integrated into the colony, achieved a unity and comfort with the apes, remarkable relationships. The other anthropologist never got beyond the social periphery of his colony, remained careful and vigilant, always seemed right on the cusp of a conflict, and never reached a harmony. And the two colonies were matched as well as could be matched in that natural study. The anthropologist couldn't understand their discrepant results. They and their teams puzzled for months until they finally found one difference. The anthropologist, who was the uncomfortable, careful outsider, carried a gun. Now, his gun never showed. He never used it. The apes never knew he had it, but he knew he had it. He knew that if things got tough, he had an out. The anthropologist, who had no gun, instead had a commitment. He knew from the beginning that he would either make it or not on his own. And then, in careful retrospect and reconstruction, each of their assumptions created the reality that they experienced. We tell our story, then our story tells us. A belief is the mind's command to the brain. With the same belief, you'll continue to have the same results. If you change your belief, you're going to have different results. Principle two. We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. Our beliefs become our reality. Some things you have to believe in order to see them even. Our possibilities are always a manifestation of what we allow ourselves to consider. A story can define possibility. And you guys know this story. In 2,000 years of recorded time, no one ran the mile in under 4 minutes. It was impossible. For 2,000 years, it had been impossible. Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile in 1954. After 2,000 years, how long do you think it took for the next 4-minute mile to occur by someone else? 46 days. And within the following 18 months, a dozen runners also broke the 4-minute mile as well. The obstacle of the impossible could no longer be constructed. Here's an interesting sidebar that I actually more recently found out. Bannister, as you know, was a physician, and he and others believed that if you actually pushed your body, that the body's physiology would not tolerate a 4-minute mile, that if you pushed your body in that way, it probably would kill you. So after he crossed the finish line, he sort of collapsed and sort of passed out. Someone revived him with smelling salts, and he looked at him and he said, "Am I dead?" That was the prevailing belief. So when the mindset of what's possible changes, reality changes as well. The beliefs within us, in our own internal map of reality, determine our perception of what surrounds us, including what and how we select, register, and process, and we construct our storyline from these premises. So that means we have to bring our beliefs about money, finances, and wealth into conscious focus to access and assess how well they work in present time. Dr. Phil's question, how's that working for you? Someone, let me skip over a story and I'll come back to it if we have time. Third principle, a new story can only occur by living in the present moment. Social scientists discover that when you measure people's present intentions, you affect their future behavior. When people, for example, are asked what they intend to do, they're more likely to act according to how they answer. Here are some studies to illustrate that. When you ask people the day before an election if they intend to vote, it increases the probability of they're going to vote by 25%. A study of 40,000 people asked, "Do you intend to buy a new car?" The question increased purchase rates over a 6-month period by 35%. Other behaviors with increased frequency, asking if people intend to eat certain foods, to diet, to exercise, to regularly fund retirement plans. The stated intention is most powerful when it's coupled with a specific action plan. Fourth principle, our minds seek closure and infer causality, whether or not it's accurate. There were a series of studies that Dr. Dan Gilbert at Harvard did to show volunteers words on a computer screen for a few milliseconds. It was actually a kind of subliminal programming. It was not enough for it to register. They couldn't even pick the words out of a multiple choice at a later point. So they were unaware the words were shown. Yet they were influenced by them. When the word hostile was flashed, volunteers judged others negatively. When the word elderly was flashed, volunteers would walk more slowly. When the word stupid was flashed, volunteers would perform slightly less well on tests. Now, when these volunteers were asked why they judged or walked or scored the way they did, they didn't say, "I don't know." They said, "No, that's not right. I responded as I always have." They were then shown before and after pictures. For example, the ones who had the word elderly flashed, the ones in that control study were shown before and after and shown how they responded by walking a bit more slowly, a bit more carefully. And they denied that having anything to do with the word they didn't see, or the word they saw but didn't register in a conscious way. They explained it by saying, well, you know, I was probably jet-lagged, or I've had some difficulty sleeping, or I was really tired when I did that test. So this is a way that we always have a reason for what we do. And that's why if you ask a client why question, they'll always come up with a why. It may or may not be related to the real reason they do something. Most likely it's not, but it immediately boots, it immediately kicks the response up into the left prefrontal cortex for something that's logical and conscious and intellectual. But it's not going to open exploration. It's probably not even going to be related to the real reason they do something. So these findings demonstrate how we desire to bring closure. Now remember, giving a client an answer, giving them how to fix something, or a suggestion even camouflaged in a question, well, have you thought about this? All brings about closure. Our brains want to end dissonance by imposing certainty. Our minds want to create a complete story by a causal explanation that infers both closure and a sense of effectiveness. Complete trumps accurate. This is why we rationalize or justify or do any number of other mental gymnastics that can bring closure without ownership or growth. A finish without an ending. This is also how confidence and clarity create an experience of trust in the listener, because this is conveyed immediately. So this is something I'd suggest that you do. Look at the four exercises in step one to be sure you get the foundation of really recognizing your money story and your authorship of it. Step two, own your money story. And here I'd suggest the specific exercise, the assumptions and motivations that construct storylines. It's on page 2.5 of the workbook. Basically, from a limitless number of possibilities, our beliefs determine what we see and then how we process it. It's our software package. Adding more information to the millions of bits of data that we process daily is not going to help, like adding a new diet or a health club membership, will likely not have an impact unless you change the software. A simple example here is that the majority, significantly over 90% of people who lose weight gain it back, often plus a pound or two or three. What they've changed for a time is their behavior, but they haven't changed their software. They haven't changed their body image. So they then immediately fill their body back to fit that internal body image. So as we look at how a storyline is constructed, here's an equation. This is the outline that I think will be helpful. Beliefs drive behavior. Behaviors drive performance. If someone is not performing as they would like or that's compromised, look at the antecedent, the behavior. If some behavior doesn't make sense or is limiting, look at that antecedent, the belief that drives it. So look at, you'll see some examples of empowering beliefs. You know, I'll find a way to love my work. I'll make the money I need. Limiting beliefs also influence reality and behavior. Every one of these, in my view, is a coachable moment. I can't find time to exercise. I don't have enough experience. I don't make enough to save anything. Remember, we get what we focus on, not what we want. So any focus, including self-talk, will be what our brain then sets to bring about. First, you have to recognize each experience as a choice instead of just the way things are. And that's our specialty in coaching, the choice architecture of this moment. how we specifically choose exactly what we think and feel and experience. So I want to apply this notion by talking about a couple of aspects here, point of reference and active versus passive position. So these are ones that I believe will be helpful to you as you listen to clients, and you will hear some beliefs and assumptions that manifest in these ways of expression. A point of reference is a basic component of story writing. People who don't own their stories have a premise of an external point of reference, and this can be an experience of passivity or resignation or just feeling helpless. They may transfer responsibility to someone or something outside themselves. So here are some characteristics when someone has an external point of reference for some particular thing. This is not across the board, but for something that they're feeling stuck in. And each of these, in my view, is a coachable moment, which is why I request permission to be able to interrupt someone at any point so we can look at something at that instant that may be helpful to look at. So here are some characteristics. They may feel as if they have little or no control over things. Life is just happening to be reacted to. Well, there's nothing I can do. Or they may feel vulnerable to the responses of others. Their language can even absolve them of responsibility. She makes me so mad. They focus on responding rather than creating. I have to do this. Being reactive instead of proactive, in other words. They see themselves perhaps as unchanging in a specific area. Well, that's just the way I am. They believe that they can only change things by changing the outside source or person. Or, this is sort of related, if they experience a symptom in their body, they may medicate it away. That's like seeing a warning light on the dash of your car and disconnecting it rather than pursuing the problem. Now, contrast that. Those with an internal point of reference see their authority as their own, as the author of their own stories. This is what we coach toward. This is why this information, and we're talking about it right now, is in recognize authorship of your own story. Because we think, well, of course we're writing our own story, but there may be instances where, as the one at the examples I just gave, where it may seem like that's not the case. Here's the characteristics of those with an internal point of reference, and this is what we develop more and more. This is the essence of what we were talking about earlier, to develop an empathic resonance so the client can develop more of their own self-reflection, self-awareness, empathy with himself. So they recognize accountability for their own lives. They're proactive. They plan. They look around the corner. Remember, this is what we coach toward. When experiencing an unpleasant result, they look at the chain of events that generated the result and look for alternatives. If they see a result that doesn't work, they decide not to continue. I mean, that's the essence of coaching. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. They decide what to change and initiate that change. They realize that the menu of choices is also created. You can choose, and you can choose how you choose. Another aspect, recognize active versus passive positions. Some examples. Well, and again, each of these are coachable ones. I ran out of time, so it couldn't work out. I can't seem to put money into saving. This just seems to keep happening. So this is something we can also hear in the language that a client uses that we can help them at the moment if they're constructing something in a passive language. Well, my doubt paralyzed me or my anxiety stopped me. The stopping comes first, and that's important to understand. The experience or the feeling that the client created is not what is being done to the client, or the client is the victim. The client is the author. It's not that something you created, like anxiety, is suddenly turning on you and stopping you. You stopped yourself, and the anxiety is part of that experience. That's the choice architecture of that moment to look at self-regulation and proceeding. likewise with some kind of identity that someone crystallizes, like I'm a bargain hunter, I'm a risk taker, I'm a procrastinator, I have imposter syndrome. It's as if that description is enough exploration, but what it does is foreclose exploration. Every client you work with at every step forward will feel discomfort. By brain and mind science definition, it's up to us to help them reframe it in a way to see that this means that you're in new territory beyond what you've been before, and this is a natural reaction rather than, oh, this is my imposter syndrome, I better take it easy. Step three, assess your money story plot and storylines. Now, again, as we talked about in the beginning, a belief or a fact is an anatomical reality in the brain, a physical part of a neuronal network. And a teacher can't present a simple explanation and remove an existing neural network from a student's brain. You can't just list three reasons an idea is wrong and expect it's going to rearrange somebody's neural network and pathways, or expect that presenting a new fact or your solution was going to overwrite the one already there. But change can occur. It's a process, an internal event, an inside job. So we want to look at reframing initially instead of anxiety. What's the opportunity? What's the challenge here? What's another way to look at this? Are there questions that you may be afraid to ask yourself? Here's one thing I want to highlight from the workbook and suggest that you do yourselves. This is one thing that I ask a number of new clients to do early on, is to do the needs and ideals exercises. It only takes a few minutes, and there's an explanation that you'll see in the workbook, I think it begins page 3.5, to look at someone's needs and ideals. That's a kind of compass, a true north, that when their needs and ideals are clear and specific, then when you're collaborating to create strategies and goals, all of them can go in the same direction. And sometimes for a client even, it's surprising that they're neglecting their needs, that they haven't taken into account their ideals in planning what they really want to do, and they've experienced some kind of compromise but not been able actually to put their finger on it specifically. So remember we talked about comfort zones in our last seminar. A comfort zone is simply a way of describing a familiar pattern of behavior. We do something repeated enough, the brain hardwires for energy efficiency to make it automatic. And then once it becomes automatic, if we depart from that, you know, it's like any departure from your home thermostat, a degree or two, one way or the other, immediately kicks in the mechanism to get it back to the comfort zone. Here's an example of a comfort zone in action. Most lottery winners manage to spend or give away their newfound winnings to return to their previous situation. In the United States, just over 80% of lottery winners file bankruptcy within the first 5 years. Their money changed, but their mindsets didn't. So much money moved them from their comfort zone, and they ended up returning to it. Here's another example. A simple Irish woman lived an ordinary life, happily, in a small village for over 4.5 decades. Then, suddenly, she was vaulted onto the world stage with Britain's Got Talent. One of the initial results for Susan Boyle was that she became overwhelmed and had to be hospitalized the day after the final competition. This was something that she had hoped for all her life, but then she, like the lottery winners, was not motivated to sabotage herself, but got on overload way beyond her comfort zone. If we have time to discuss it, this is the next area of research, piece of work, book I'm writing. something that I think we need to look at a good deal more in coaching is how to deal with extreme success, because so many of your clients will get beyond what they've ever imagined in terms of success by working with you. So remember, since the choices we make tend to be from our comfort zone, that a habit is not a definition. It's simply a choice that gets repeated. Now, part of the assessment of your money story is to understand conflicted and contradictory storylines. Basically, when you feel with one part of the brain and plan with another, you need a map. A dilemma means having two or more mental maps in conflict. For example, if you read the anxiety or uncertainty of a new experience in an old paradigm, such as anxiety equals danger ahead or uncertainty means wrong decision, it makes sense to stop. And remember, we discussed that our brains can't tell the difference between anxiety and excitement. How you frame it will determine whether you head for cover or whether you move ahead and engage the challenge and the opportunity. That's what we do as coaches. This is the juncture. This is a prime example of our specialty of choice architecture, is how we frame something. You know, a client says, well, I consulted recently with someone whose client repetitively said, I don't know. And the coach was so frustrated. And I said, the next time with the first, I don't know, I suggest, you know, I understand you don't know. That's the beginning. Let's look at some possibilities, or let's look at a first step. So you accept what a client says, then we look at framing it in a different way. A current paradigm reframes excitement and trepidation of moving ahead in new territory as a signpost of progress, as validation of moving ahead. This is how we help our clients transform their identity, because as they're moving ahead and incorporating change, we're discussing that, validating that, reflecting that back to them, so it becomes a part of the process of our collaboration that they are aware of reframing. They're aware of their changes and their experiences. So this is something that we're doing actually while we're talking about other things. So one of the unique qualities that we have as human beings is self-awareness, the ability to reflect on how we think and what we do. This means that we can learn from our experiences and from others' experiences as well. This is why we can create a new story. We are not our old story. We created our old story. We are not our habits or our thoughts. We create them. We can think about these things and reflect on them and examine our paradigms to see if they serve us well. Now, there are a lot of studies that show money is not related to happiness and many other things it promises or represents. And it becomes a unique portal to the unconscious. It becomes a Rorschach, all the things we talked about last time. But here is one thing that, as you think about it, the one thing money influences for all classes, all groups of people, everywhere in the world, choice. That's the only thing I could say that's ubiquitous about money. It's related to choice. So we can assess our money stories in four ways. Monitor our choices, really objectively, not continuing to inhabit the story we want to believe. Question our ideas. Is this really working? Probe our reasoning. And again, ask clearly and honestly, does this work? Now, here's a quote for the guys, because we are inevitably the ones who will not stop and ask for directions even when we're hopelessly lost. C.S. Lewis said, "We all want progress, but progress means getting nearer to the place where you want to be. And if you've taken a wrong turn, then to go forward does not get you any nearer. If you're on the wrong road, progress means doing an about turn and going back to the right road. In that case, the man who turns back soonest is the most progressive man." Notice that Lewis even said man. Here's an application. You're always reaching your goals, whether they're conscious or unconscious. So it may be helpful to look at what your unconscious goals are. Here's an example of that. We have a surface story. The surface story is what we logically and consciously want. I want to generate more income. I want to create wealth. Now, that 90 to 95% of the unconscious operating process may be at work on a story that goes the opposite direction, the shadow story. And that shadow story may manifest. You may hear it as a coach when your client talks about the lack of confidence, the lack of belief. I don't think I can really do it. Some people are just made for money. Some people, I don't think money is spiritual. There are many things that go into that shadow story. It's like when you ask a client at the end of each session, what do you commit to do before we meet again? When a client begins with, I'll try, I need to, I should, I ought to, those built-in takeaways, you immediately listen to the construction of that story plan and clarify and confront it. You know, what will you commit to? Because here are the words of someone committed. I will. So, to create a new belief, I want to summarize this and save a bit of time for discussion. How we tell our stories of the past will shape our future. Some stories get told so much and so often, they achieve the status of becoming a personal myth. If I were just loved enough. If I just had enough money. When you're ready to write a new belief, focus on it frequently and return to it regularly. The new belief has to replace the old belief. One of the reasons that therapy may not be adequate here. To come to the end of the past doesn't create a new story for you to inhabit and engage. So when you're ready to write a new belief, focus on it frequently. Return to it regularly. A brief story to illustrate the value of how we attribute, the belief of how it can fundamentally change how we perceive something. And this is especially a goofy story to make a point. And I want the point to have way more valence than the beauty of the story. Nathan Handworker. Now, you know this better be a good story with a name like that. Nathan Handworker put in a new food stand in Coney Island, 1916. His hot dogs were pure beef, made from his wife's recipe, and every bit as delicious as competitors, but he priced his at 5 cents, and other hot dogs were priced at 10 cents. He attracted few to no customers, depending on the day. People wondered if his hot dogs were inferior and attributed poor quality ingredients to his products. His sales were not increased when he offered free root beer and free pickles. The free products furthered the perception that the value must be really substandard. Then Handworker came up with a new strategy. He asked doctors from a nearby hospital to stand eating his hot dogs while they were wearing their white coats and stethoscopes, and he raised his prices significantly. His hot dogs started selling. People assumed that if physicians were eating his food and it cost at least as much as his competitors, and in most instances more, it had to be good. So Nathan's famous hot dogs began selling well, became a national phenomenon, and still exists today. So creating a new belief is not an instantaneous thing. It's a process. It takes however long it takes. It's your process, not anyone else's. And you don't need, and this is in response to a couple of the questions, you don't need motivation to do anything. Think about that. You do not need motivation to do anything that you decide to do. All you need is a plan and to stick to it, a system and commitment. Many of you have heard me use various illustrations. I work with pro athletes and actors. They are not motivated to go to the gym every day, but they do because they know they need to do that in order to do what's next. They have a plan, and they stick to it. So in changing your belief and the result of the change in your action, you're also changing your mind and your brain. And you will always be able to tell the difference between dosing and timing and titrating from avoidance or procrastination. That's a really important distinction. Now, at any moment in time, neural networks are influenced by three factors: genes, experiences, and forced attention. Regardless of someone's unique brain architecture and individual complexity, these three factors intersect at any moment and any nanosecond. DNA downloads its information from expression of its code. We now know it can go in the other direction. This is the entire science of epigenetics. Our experiences, our beliefs, can actually turn genes off or turn them on to determine the major extent of the expression of DNA-based information. That's how powerful a new story can be. So, a final thought. What remains unconscious will mostly be attributed to fate. Okay, we're in discussion mode now, so if you'll again manage the background noise. I'm interested in any thoughts, questions, or further aspects of this that you'd like to discuss. Questions or clarifications?
Yeah, David.
Yes?
Dave, it's Peter. Hi, it's Peter Graves.
Welcome. Hey.
I'm just clarifying that other people didn't get what I got in terms of the two documents you sent. I received Stress Mastery and Peak Performance, and then a resource guide that looks like it's...
Okay, I mean, yes, you did, but that was a mistake. Let me send around again, because that was for the seminar series I completed before this one began. So that was a mistake. Send around.
I just want to make sure nobody else got that, and I'm enjoying reading it for my sports. So
you got a freebie. So
let me
send the correct one around. My apologies.
Okay,
and
Dave.
From CTA, and there's an outline and a workbook associated with the current story here about money.
Okay.
So I'll be sure that I send that to
Thanks,
everyone.
Dave. Appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. And
yeah, Dave, I have
up.
A question.
Yeah, go ahead. This is...
This is Dubai from Maryland. One of the things you said that jarred my thinking, and I appreciate the wisdom that you're giving us, it's just amazing, is that to create a new story, it has to be done in the present. And I was trying to figure out how creating a story in the present can override stories that came out of the past, and the past had certain experiences that may not have been as that may have been more powerful then than it is now. Could you kind of help me understand how we could do that, please?
Okay, let's talk about how it happens in your mind and your brain. Whatever you think and feel and experience, you're creating this moment. Now, there may be an automatic or a default mode that you may go into, just like driving the same way to work every day. You don't have to think about it because your brain has laid down a track that you can listen to an audiobook but still get there. Now, this is for when what we're talking about now is looking at and assessing a current story and every aspect of it to see if it's working or not. So there may be an old storyline, and money is the prototype of this kind of situation because there is so much that we downloaded without even being aware of it by watching our parents, by being around them and being around people important to us in our environment. We would observe how parents would use money to express things, how they regarded money, how they regarded people who had more or less, what they thought money would do. All the things we talked about last seminar about a money story, we observed and downloaded these aspects from our parents. I worked with a woman, for example, who talked about sort of a true confession. She said, I want to tell you, Dave, I have a really goofy habit. I have now a dozen sets, complete sets of china, because when I grew up, I only had paper plates. Now, she was still in that story. She was in the flip side of it, but she was still in that story. So what we came to do then was to look at the flip side of scarcity seemed to be a dozen sets of china. So we're looking at understanding how we construct a story and the meaning to create the freedom to construct our own story here and now and to recognize what we want and the simplicity of doing that, of not having the automatic attachments and meanings that can divert how we experience something or how we express it, like the lottery winners who couldn't keep the $3 million and more because it didn't fit their stories, because their stories were of scarcity, and they got back there in fairly short order. Does that begin to answer your question about what we do in coaching is we listen for how someone is constructing their own experience, and we have the ability, unique to all people in the world, nobody else in the world can get away with what we can get away with. That's why we need to develop a working alliance with somebody so that they will know unequivocally that we have their best interest at heart, and that someone will know when I interrupt them, I'm not being rude. I'm excited about this opportunity because of what I just heard for us to look at something and see if it works or see if there's something that can work better or something that's been there all along that has been there from early on as an assumption that's been limiting, but now we're seeing some glimmers of it, and now we can look at that in a specific way to look at how they may choose something different or how they may choose exactly what they want rather than it being an automatic connection with something from the past. Does that, we'll talk some more about this, and this is what the roadmap process is really about, to answer your question, but does this help kind of set?
It does. It, especially when you say that what we're trying to do is shift them from their external point of view to let them know that they can create their own stories, and as they create them from what they're beginning to see from the self-awareness and reflection, that they have, it's a choice, and they can make a choice
to
make it better.
And we've talked about the first three steps of that very process in this seminar, to recognize authorship, to own your story, and then to assess the plot and the storylines to see what works and what doesn't work. And then next seminar will begin with deciding what to change, about making informed choices about what to keep, what to let go, to change and enhance. So we're going through this in a systematic way. So we've begun to answer your question using this particular system, the roadmap system. So it's a great question and a great question for right now. And, you know, hang on. We'll do more of this and complete this over the next two seminars. We're out of time, and I want to respect that. Thank you all very much for your responses, your exchanges. It's really helpful to me to get a better sense to incorporate discussions. I look forward to picking up right here next time. And look for an email from me for the correct accompaniment to our seminar. Thanks very, very much. See you guys. Bye.
Thank you, too. Have a good evening.
Yep.
don't want to hear about going to school. You want to have a